Vente Polvoros for creating disturbance.
This is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm here in the University of Plymouth with Christopher German. Christopher, you want to present yourself quickly?
Yeah, hi Roger. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to have an interview with you. I'm a PhD student here at the University of Plymouth. Previously, I did a master's here in Plymouth in psychological research methods, where I actually focused on syllogistic reasoning and ego depletion. And before that, I did a bachelor in psychology in Amsterdam, where I did work on embodied cognition, and we used a lot of neuroscientific theorizing in order to motivate our research.
Yeah. Very good. And so you're halfway through your PhD thesis here, and the nominal topic is quantum cognition.
That's right.
And so maybe you can unpack that just very briefly.
Okay, quantum cognition is a novel emerging field within the cognitive sciences, and basically it applies the mathematical formalism of quantum theory to cognitive phenomena. So, for example, the probability theory which underlies quantum theory is completely different from the normative probability theory, which is also called classical probability theory, which is actually used all over the place. So when we talk about cognitive modeling, we might talk about Bayesian networks or connectionist networks or production rule models. These are all based on classical probability theory. And one of the most intriguing aspects of quantum probability theory is the concept of superposition. And if you like, I could elaborate on that a bit.
So I think what's interesting to me here is so often when we transfer or translate ideas from quantum mechanics to other fields of application, often we stay in sort of a metaphorical space. And here what you're doing and other people are doing is transferring the specific mathematical formalism and the kind of probability theory that's been developed for quantum phenomena and applying it to psychological phenomena.
Exactly.
And as I understand it from what we were chatting before, you're actually going to do some specific experiments that you will then analyze using this mathematical formalism. So what are those experiments going to be?
So basically, we're looking at non-commutativity in decision-making. In classical probability theory, you have the concept of commutativity, which is A and B should be the same as B and A. So question order effects shouldn't matter. And we are looking at non-commutativity in visual decision making. It's quite analogous to regular decision making, but we focus on the visual process because it's the best understood process when it comes to the perceptual system. That's why we are looking at visual decision making and order effects.
So you're looking at the order of, you're changing the order of a visual stimulus and seeing that how that affects a judgment or a decision?
Exactly, and how making a judgment in one instance influences a subsequent judgment. So we are interested in order effects and if the process of measuring, which is the same as making a judgment, because making a judgment is just an introspective measurement, changes a subsequent measurement. So that's it in a nutshell.
So one of the areas of application that you mentioned is indeed in informing political judgments, that indeed the order in which things happen may affect the political judgment you make. So can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, actually have been even meta-analytic studies which show that quantum probability models are much better in explaining political decision-making when it comes to order effects than classical models. So a simple example would be a Gallup poll which has been conducted with 1,002 people, split sample technique. One half of the population was asked, is Al Gore honest, and then if Clinton is honest, and the other half of the sample was asked exactly the same question but in the reverse order. And interestingly, you find completely different statistics for both conditions, and this is obviously incongruent with the commutativity principle I was just talking about. And afterwards, researchers, like I already alluded to, did meta-analytic research, and they found that the goodness of fit index of a quantum probability model is much better than a classical model. Obviously, there are other explanations in the Kahneman and Tversky framework, but...
I'm just going to make a joke, because when I was a graduate student in astrophysics, some of my colleagues went to work in Wall Street. They were called rocket scientists because they were applying the mathematics they used in astrophysics for analyzing stock markets. So maybe you have a good career ahead of you as a quantum physicist in political consulting.
To be honest, it's debatable if these quantum principles are actually applicable to the macro domain.
Yeah.
And I'm actually more interested in cognitive processes than the axiomatic framework. But what I found really interesting is when you think about the divide between micro and macro, it's not that clear anymore, because people have found quantum effects like entanglement with large molecules and even diamonds. So the dichotomy between micro and macro is actually quite blurry, and we don't know exactly where the micro world stops and where the macro world starts.
I suspect it doesn't reach up to the size of Al Gore and Bill Clinton, but who knows? Let me steer this discussion in a slightly different direction. So one of your other interests that you just came back from a conference on, a conference called Breaking Conventions, I think, was in some of the current research on a psychoactive drug called DMT. So just give us a few words about that, and then I'd like to pick up on that on a more general thing about the way science is done. So just tell us a little bit about DMT.
So DMT is an acronym for N,N-dimethyltryptamine, which is a chemical which has a very simple molecular structure and which is ubiquitous in nature. So it can be found in many animals and plants. Recently, it has been found in the human brain, and even more recently, it has been found in the rat's pineal gland, which is really interesting from a neuroscientific point of view. DMT is really hard to explain when it comes to the phenomenological effects, because it has been described as ineffable, but just in a nutshell, it influences visual perception in the most spectacular way, and it changes many of our core cognitive capacities in ways which are really hard to imagine, because it's a consciousness expanding compound which actually has been described as a really transformative experience by people who use this compound. At the moment, there is not much research going on in this domain, but times are changing, and I just came, like you already said, from a conference in London where Professor David Nichols and Professor Nutz from Imperial College London gave presentations on the future of psychedelics in science.
You said in the case of this particular compound, in fact, in most universities, research is not allowed on that, on this chemical, or
it's a Class A substance. Yeah. So the DEA is obviously restricting research in that sense.
Even though it's a naturally occurring substance in the human body.
You make a great point. Actually, we could all go to jail right now because we are carrying that compound in our brain. And it's really closely related to serotonin, which is quite interesting for everybody who is interested in neurochemistry.
The reason I just wanted to mention it, other than you've been educating me about this particular chemical, is... one of the things, we're in this program called Cognovo, which is an unusual Marie Curie, because indeed the PhD students come from very different disciplines. You're from the cognitive sciences, and there are people from robotics, there are artists. And obviously one of the ideas that the organizers of this is indeed that by bringing together these people with very different disciplinary approaches and problems, in fact, you feed into new kinds of ideas. And in chatting with you, clearly you have an interest in scientific areas that are a little bit on the edge of received wisdom. And so, just talk a little bit about how you're finding the Cognovo experience and how it feeds into your own scientific interest.
Yeah, I think it's a really great opportunity because you can communicate with people from diverse fields who have completely different educational backgrounds, and obviously there is mimetic diversity in our group. I think especially robotics is a field which at the moment makes a lot of progress, so from a perspective of exponential progress in information technology, we can expect a lot. And the arts are obviously also picking up on these topics because transhumanism is a huge issue or a big topic in these fields. So from that point of view, it's a really enriching experience because you get confronted with different perspectives from people from different fields. And
so, obviously, we don't have time here, but on another Creative Disturbance podcast, I had a discussion in French with Edmond Couchot, who is virulently against the ideas of post and transhumanism. Hmm. What he's really interested in and is convinced is what is going on is that we're getting into a real symbiotic coevolution of human systems and other systems. Hmm. And so rather than thinking of augmenting humans, we're actually in a coevolution symbiosis at the moment.
I can see that as well. Yeah. So the miniaturization of technology is one aspect, and the technology is getting closer and closer to our brain, basically. And there are many studies which investigate computer brain interfaces.
But beyond that, we have distributed systems that are embedded in our ecology, which is a distributed system, and so that the post and transhumanism way of looking at the problem, he's convinced at least that is the wrong way to think about it. We've got a couple of minutes left. Your PhD advisor is Chris Harris, so he's very much in the discipline that you have?
Not at all, actually. Uh-huh. I introduced the topic to him. He's a specialist when it comes to the visual system. Yeah. That's why we are focusing on visual decision making. Yeah. But quantum cognition, like I said, is a really new field. And I just wanted to add one more point. You said that I'm interested in the edges of science or the friction. Actually, my background is a pretty solid background in cognitive science.
But I think part of that also is you're quite self-reflective about your scientific practice, and most scientists are not all that self-reflective, right? And so you're very aware of how scientific ideas get formulated, tested. You and I have read a fair amount of philosophy of science, and we sort of understand that the scientific method itself is embedded in human systems.
Exactly, and the demarcation criterion, which was formulated by Karl Popper, is obviously still a very interesting topic. Where does science stop and where does non-science start? We can't actually answer that question very easily. And hypothesis testing, the p-value is discussed heavily in our days. Yeah. There's a recent Nature paper which actually criticizes hypothesis testing with null hypotheses heavily, there is a lot of movement in the basic methodology of science.
It was less a comment about the fringe or the edge, but the self-reflectivity that I've heard you express, of being aware that your scientific method is embedded in the social system, and then you have to navigate what you're trying to make as scientific conclusions, but in some cases, it's the DA is forbidding you to test a certain chemical that's in your own body. So, we're going to have to wrap it up there, Christopher. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Got a vintage over us for creative disturbance.